This is BBC. BBC Radio. Six Music. Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time.
And welcome to The First Time. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. That could be the first single they bought, the first gig they went to, the recording of the first hit, or even meeting their biggest heroes. Today's guest has reasonable claim to be one of the greatest guitarists of all time. He's certainly the most famous, celebrated and influential player alive. Someone who translated his obsession with blues musicians like Big Bill Brunsey, Brownie McGee and Muddy Waters into a style of playing that dominated huge bands like the Yardbirds, the Blues Breakers, Cream and Blind Faith. His playing and that of his friend Jimi Hendrix, maybe his only real contemporary, helped define the 60s and then the 70s. He's played with the Beatles, both individually and as a band, Aretha Franklin, Carole King, Buddy Guy, Elton John, The Band, Frank Zappa, B.B. King and Kate Bush. My guest on The First Time this week is Eric Clapton.
Thinking about the times you drove in my car. Thinking that I might have drove you too far.
In this extremely rare one-to-one interview, we talk about his very earliest influences, his first gig, his first hit, as well as his relationship with Hendrix and what it was like recording with people like the Beatles and Aretha Franklin. We also talk about his well-publicised battle with drugs and alcohol and address an infamous concert he played in 1976 at the height of his addiction when he made a speech on stage supporting Enoch Powell and the National Front, something that prompted the foundation of the Rock Against Racism campaign. And we see how he regards these comments some 40 years later. But I started by asking Eric, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
Oh, yeah. I mean, think in the pubs, you know, around where I was brought up in Ripley, local people singing and playing instruments, playing violin and guitar, banjo. I mean, this is Ripley, Surrey, believe it or not. It sounds like the, you know, the backwoods of Tennessee, but it was pretty much the same thing. It was everywhere. Everyone sang.
What, so kind of like folk stuff, you know?
No, kind of wartime songs, you know, Underneath the Arches or We'll Meet Again, that kind of thing. Just pop songs of the day.
Underneath the arches, we dream our dreams away. Underneath the arches, on cobblestones we lay.
And I mean, were you fascinated by that even from that very, very earliest age?
Oh, yeah, especially the emotional stuff, you know, that all the Gracie Field stuff and Flanagan and Allen, all of it seemed to be very moving, obviously because it was post-war. I mean, I was born just before the war ended. So there were a lot of that emotion was in all the singing, you know, and entertainment, local entertainment. Everybody was into it, you know.
This is the BBC Home Service. Hello, children everywhere.
Because you talk about Uncle Mac hearing that on the radio.
Yes.
And, quite a sort of mature reaction to that music at such a young age.
Well, I'd already been exposed to it, you see, and I don't think we even had a radio until I was about 9 years old. So then I was exposed to a lot more varied cultures. You know, it wasn't just English music hall. Where was it? English. That's exactly what I was hearing, was music hall. And then I heard kind of blues and jazz and stuff like that, and opera too. But it was the spectrum just grew very quickly. And Uncle Mac was like kind of the head DJ, if you like, of that time, because he took risks, you know.
That phrase that you use, blues made the pain go away, which seemed just kind of heart-wrenching, really.
Yeah. It peaked at that point because I think what I liked about it was it was something that nobody else knew about. So I made it mine, you know. But all music up until that time, it had that same effect on me, but it was much more of a shared experience, you know, that, and but hearing blues became a unique thing for me that I could identify with.
What would be the? Is there one song specifically?
Well, I had an album by Big Brunzi, which is now very hard to get over. And the one that got me on that album was Lonesome Road, walking down that Lonesome Road. And that was the first kind of shuffle, slow blues shuffle I'd ever heard. And it was in echo, and there was a sound of footsteps on it, which I think were artificial, but it was very overpowering for me to listen. If you can find it, good luck.
Walking. to go. Oh, Lord, no place to room and go. Things look so dark, baby, down that road ahead. Things look so dark, down that road ahead. Ah, you get it thinking about the way living. Oh, Lord, and what your mother said. Things are so lonesome when you ain't got a shelter over your head. You ain't got a shelter over your head. Now, when you could have been at home, ooh, Lord, sleeping in a feather bed. This road is so lonesome when you gotta travel, travel all alone. Road is so lonesome when you gotta travel all alone. Now, when all you got in this world, ooh, Lord, out of class, she's dead and gone.
What about the very first time you performed in front of an audience of any description?
I was with a band called the Roosters. Yeah, and I was very young. I was probably about 17. And I just got an electric guitar, and but I didn't have an amp. It was a semi-acoustic electric guitar, so I could play along at home and hear it, but I'd never plugged it in. And then so we had one amplifier, which I think was a Selma Varitone, and the vocal went through that, the guitar went through that, and the bass, all in the one amp, and it sounded fantastic in a way because it was like mono. And I was, actually felt quite confident because it was in a pub. The band knew what we wanted to do. And because we knew that nobody else had heard this music, I think that gave us a certain amount of confidence, you know.
What did you play? Can you remember?
We played Bo Diddley songs. Can't Judge a Book by the Cover. We played Got My Mojo Work, and you know, varied songs by more R&B people like Howling Wolf and Muddy Waters. Although it was blues, it was sort of very well known blues.
You can't judge apple by looking at a tree. You can't judge honey by looking at the bee. You can't judge a daughter by looking at the mother. A book by looking at the cover. Oh, can't you see? Oh, you misjudged me. I look like a farmer, but I'm a lover. Can't judge the book by looking at the cover.
I'm really interested in this, the level of obsession that you seem to have, this sense of someone who's anything that wasn't music, that wasn't the blues, that wasn't physically playing, seemed like almost an irrelevance in your early life. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, I think so. I think I had tunnel vision for quite a long time. I was frightened, I suppose, that something anything that would distract me from my studies, as it were, had to be pushed to one side. I was very interested in jazz, though. It was funny because I liked having seen a film called Jazz on a Summer's Day. I was blown away by a couple of people. And I was at Jimmy Guffrey is playing at the beginning of that film. And it's so delicate and light, and it's so blues orientated that I felt it was easy to get into John Coltrane or Thelonious Monk. Obviously, more of the well-known 50s and 60s jazz musicians, they were quite accessible. And if I went looking for blues records, they would all be in the same area of the shop, and they all had the same aura of mystique, you know.
If we should play some jazz, then, at this point, what, should we play something off that record?
Let me think. My Favourite Things by Coltrane.
First time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Eric Clapton. In the recent film biopic about Eric, Life in 12 Bars, he talks about the myth behind the Yardbirds' 1965 single, For Your Love. It was his first big hit, but according to legend, it prompted him to leave the band, something I asked Eric about. There's a segment in the film again, you're talking about For Your Love, and you're talking about how, like, that's it, we've sold out. You've sold out, and you just once again this sort of tunnel vision again. I think you even describe yourself as kind of like, oh, it's quite a nasty piece of work. You were so set on this vision that must have been quite a difficult thing for people around you to live with, and for you just to deal with being that, you know, so focused, like a kind of laser point at just this purest thing.
Well, I have to defend myself a bit on that because our manager at the time, Giorgio Gamowski, almost gave us a kind of a task, you know, that we had to all go out individually and find something that we could record that would be successful and chart worthy. And I found an Otis Redding song, and I thought, well, this has a certain amount of appeal that it, so it could be, it could work its way up, you know, maybe get to number 10 or so, even though we were completely unknown. But they had this thing from Grant Goldman, and it was obviously much more poppy. And I had been wary of pop, and already we'd been sort of coaxed into doing a couple of adverts to earn some money and trying to get some exposure. This is with the Yardbirds, of course, and I, so everyone came up with something. I can't remember what everyone else had, but I think Paul Samuel Smith thought that this was really obvious choice. So my choice was shoved to one side, and I suppose I was jealous and very disappointed that we were going to move off in that direction. So I kind of threw all the toys went out the pram, you know, and that was that. I'm giving up. I'm never playing again. And it wasn't a mature choice at all.
Dream on me at
'67, Aretha Franklin, New York. I mean, good God.
Yeah.
An incredible session. What were your memories of first kind of walking in and being in the presence of already, you know, a legend?
Yeah, I mean, I was overwhelmed, really. I just went to the place where I knew I was comfortable in the way I played. And there were, you know, at least four great guitar players in the room, and that's the way they made their records. Everyone was on the floor. I don't know if what was overdubbed, if anything, maybe the horn section from time to time, but otherwise it was live. And I was, you know, I was put to the test. And the only time in that recording where it became too difficult, I mean, I found it quite easy to do, was they had a middle eight. There's a middle section where they went through a passage of sort of gospel chords where I had no idea what to do. I could only play in one key and, you know, 12 bars, really. And I got to the middle, I just stopped. And that's what someone said to me, if you don't know what to play, stop. That was good advice.
Oh,
wonder, could I borrow yours? As easy as you could mine. Because when you need my love, and I give time after time, and turn around to find me no returns, then my friend, you've used my time. If there's one.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time the show where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Eric Clapton. And that was, of course, I Feel Free by Cream from 1966. 2 years later, Eric would further cement his reputation as the scene's most celebrated guitarist with one very special session, which I asked him about. Obviously, there's some stories that people are going to kind of always return to, and one of them is, obviously, While My Guitar Gently Weeps. I mean, how do you play on someone else's track that's going to be have some empathy to what they do, but not just be echoing what someone else would stylistically play within the group and entering that chemistry?
By the time we got to do that, and by the time I was invited to do it, I was flying high, full of arrogance and confidence, you know. So I was very flattered that I'd been asked to do it by George, but I sensed in the way that that he was being underestimated within the group. So, and we'd become mates. So I thought, well, I'd really like to help, you know. And when I heard the song, I thought, well, I can do this, because it was in a minor key to begin with, which suggests that it could be played as a blues. I thought, well, this wouldn't be too hard. And I really wanted to make him happy. You know, I really wanted to support his cause. So it gave me an extra amount of energy to do it, you know, and it was great to do it. I think that might have been the second take. There might have been two takes, and just thought, well, this is how it's done. And those guys, that's what they could do too. You know, they'd been playing for so long together that they were speaking the language, speaking to one another, and I just managed to cop a feel, you know.
Just two takes, that's kind of insane.
Yes, a lot of stuff was done like that because it was a question of time, you know, that studio time was very expensive. No one was making that much money. Even then, it was still a relative thing that you had to kind of work out how much you could do in a day, and maybe four songs or two songs, and get them as good as you could, as quick as you could. And also, they're aware, as I'm aware, that the amount of passion you can put into something is sometimes very short-lived, and then it just gets to be dull.
Surely be learning.
Another first I want to ask you about is, can you remember the first time you saw Goodfellas and the first time you saw that piece of music laid over that particular scene? Because it's become, as well as being kind of one of those songs that belongs to the whole world now, that very few artists have.
Oh, Layla. Okay, well, yeah, that they use the piano concerto at the end, because it's like that. And, you know, the story behind that was that it was Jim Gordon's piece. And he was recording after we'd all quit for the day. You know, we'd work during the day and then maybe into the evening. We'd go home and Jim would stay there. And he was making his own album. And that was one of the songs. And we kind of did a deal, you know, that we'd let him carry on using our surplus time if we could have that piece. And so we just stuck it on the end. And, you know, his part is the piano, the melody on the piano, and then we just improvised on top.
Because, you know, it's iconic song meets iconic piece of cinema, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, it is. I saw it in Australia, and we just didn't know much about the movie, looking forward to it because we love Scorsese. I can't remember who I was with, what band, but went to see it in Australia, and I was blown away by the use of it. He takes some Ginger's solo somewhere near the end of the film when it's starting to get crazy. There's a section of Toad that Ginger used to play that was, I thought, really, really clever with the amount of violence that was going on. It was a good match.
One of the things in terms of your relationship with Jimi Hendrix that you really get in the film was kind of how natural and easy it was. You're kind of sort of expecting some great rivalry, but it seemed like such a humane friendship.
Yeah.
Can you remember where you were when you first heard that he'd died? Can you remember that moment?
Yeah, I had gone. I was supposed to meet Jimmy at the Lyceum. And it was the night he passed, and we were going to see Sly and the Family Stone, and he was phenomenal. He is phenomenal, Sly. I mean, absolutely admire him beyond belief, and he's pretty crazy, but he's still a great musician. And he was notorious for being late. I think he was about 2 hours late, and I was there, and while I was waiting for Sly to come on, I got the news. And, you know, like, it's, you know, this has happened a few times. And I always go numb, you know. I think that's perhaps a standard reaction. And, it takes a few days, if not more, obviously, actually a lot more, to realize that something like that has happened. It just is impossible to grasp at the time, but it was devastating news, really. Yeah, we were very close, and there was not many people we knew played that way. I mean, I knew a lot of guitar players in England. I mean, chiefly the guy that I would have tip my hat to more than anyone was Albert Lee. You know, we became good buddies, and he was playing with Chris Farlow then, and a phenomenal guitar player. But there weren't many guys that I thought had been deeply interested in the blues as I was, and all of the modern blues players too. And Jimmy was, he was deep. He understood all that, and he was able to play it and more. You know, I hear him every now and then in the background on the radio or something, and I hear that vibrato and everything. But he's the only guy that could do that, and it's very evocative.
Talk about this in the film as well. You do address the concert, that concert in 76 when you made a speech on stage,
yeah,
supporting Enoch Powell on the National Front. It prompted a profound reaction from the public and from other musicians. It does kind of continue to impact on the way people think about you. As was part of this film an apology, an explanation? I mean, how does someone address that?
Well, I mean, it's an easy way out, but I blame the drink, and I regret so many things that I did when I was drunk, and I was drunk for a very, very long time, and that may have been near the end of my drinking, where I was out of control. I mean, that was one concert that portrayed the outness of it all, but there were many, many more. And the early one, where I think Jamie Oldacre was saying he didn't know where he was, and this was a show that I should never have done. I mean, most of those shows I shouldn't have done, but nobody had the wherewithal then about how to assess alcoholism, you know, was not because everyone was getting stoned and everyone was saying things like me that were outrageous and irresponsible. And obviously, it was only after the event. I didn't feel anything at all about saying things like that. It just seemed to be fairly normal, let's say, to say dreadful things in front of on a microphone. And I was like that in pubs. I was like that in parties. I was just horrendous to be anywhere near. As for the political side of it, I don't know what I was talking about. I mean, I did feel that there were changes taking place, which were difficult or unusual. And I got on my high horse about that and got in lots of trouble.
And how do you feel about seeing that footage now?
It's very painful. but it's got to be true. I mean, there's no, there's, you know, then when I worked with the director on this, I said, well, you know, there's got, you've got to put everything in that is, relates to my story. I mean, there's, you can't hold back. So, but, and I knew there was footage. And I also knew there was more footage about stuff I said on the train when we recorded a tour on a train in Germany that was just as embarrassing and humiliating for me. But, you know, and it's, I've sat through this with audiences in New York and Toronto, and I just feel like I want the floor to open me up. But I'm boisted a little bit by the fact that I was a drunk. You know, I now see myself as a, I'm a recovering drunk. I have all kinds of thoughts in my mind, which I could be put in prison for. But then it just used to come out without any restraint, you know.
In terms of post-recovery, or yeah, if you say like as an ongoing recovery, are you comfortable? Are you comfortable with being Eric Clapton? Are you kind of... Because, you know, the fame part of it, the recognition part of it never really seemed to be the point. And obviously some of it was resulting in some fantastic music and some of it took you to some places that you'd really rather not have gone down.
Yeah. I'm very happy that I'm alive. I'm very... I have things that I shouldn't really ought to have, and I'd end up being locked up. What was my worst fear as a drunk... towards the end of my drinking was that they were going to lock me up and that, you know, I'd be get electric shock treatment or stuff like that. And and I seriously saw suicide as an option to that, and then picked up the phone instead and asked someone to help. And that was, you know, that was a very, very new experience for me. I'd never done anything like that before. So ever since then, my life has changed and for the better, and I have a family. I'm involved with a lot of people who want to carry the message of being sober as an option, you know, rather than, you know, fate of going out in a blaze of glory and a bottle of whiskey. So I'm pretty content. I still, you know, have trouble with my past, but, you know, someone said to me, that's your greatest asset. You know, where you've come from is very important to where you are now. And so as much as I regret the things that I did, especially in public, I have to accept that it's my past and it's brought me to where I am, really.
And kind of bringing things back to the start. I mean, has, if you were that kid and the blues made the pain go away, has that worked? Has it saved you, do you think, now?
Music is still my first place to go and hide. And my family are very aware of this, because if they have music, if we're eating dinner and there's, you know, music in the background, if the conversation gets a little bit... unfamiliar for me, if they start talking about their friends at school and I think, well, I don't know that, I'm gone instantly and to whatever's playing on in the background. And so that's still my cave. But other than that, I have a group of friends that I see all the time who are trying to do the same thing as me and just staying sober, and we get together and that has the same effect, thank goodness.
And the last question, final thing, pick a final song. What should we go out on?
Purple Rain.
Why that song?
Because he was the king. And that song got to me, interestingly enough, in the middle of a relapse from drinking, I went to see Purple Rain. And it was a point when I'd lost all, really, I had no hope. And that song and his personality, his musicianship... and soul gave me hope again.
Prince saved you.
You could say that. You could say that, yeah. And I was devastated again when he passed. I thought, Dub, what? How could that happen? You know, how could anyone have stopped that? Was it? Would it have been possible to have been able to stop that? I think it would, but some people just slip through, you know.
I never meant to call you when you fall. I never meant to call you when you pain. I don't want to stand out to you laughing.
Music.
This is
Six Music. We'll be right back. dance hall and the night begins, you have to put it all. All these visions of a welcoming party, pretty party, have been lost. 'Cause it's the same since I left on this ship of promises. All the churches I remember well, clocking in and out to the sound of the bell, we just put it on. It takes you in, it scrubs you clean, it sanitizes every dream, and you put it on, you just put it on. But I'll meet you in between what I say and what I mean, and we will make our own mess on this ship of promises. 'Cause it's the same since we left on this ship of promises. Oh, we just could not care less on this ship of promises. Don't look back.
Six Music. This morning from 11, Huey Morgan.
At 8, Radcliffe and Marconi.
Right now.
Right now. It's Chris Hawkins.